So this proposal is a result of our work on the medical home project in the department. And we started that a few years ago. These are some of my collaborators. The one here is Dr. Bob Levine back there, and he's the director of our research division, preventive medicine. Specialty is preventive medicine, and the rest are our collaborators. So thanks to all my collaborators on this project, and just to say that we have nothing to disclose. So the purpose of the project was to evaluate the effectiveness of a chronic disease management program for type 2 diabetes in an academic primary care indigent practice. The aims were to establish a baseline pre-intervention and then implement the chronic care model with some modifications and perform a quality assessment after that. Of course, the sample used was a convenience sample, and it's really part of the clinical practice. There were 250 diabetics enrolled in two clinics. The two clinics are both residency training clinic for family medicine residents, and they serve mostly an urban population. The patients initially completed an intake assessment, including the readiness to change. The treatment team or the management team did very heavy case coordination by contacting patients by phone, and if there was no response, letters were sent out. It is worth mentioning that our patient population, there's a high percentage of disconnected phones, plus many of them do not respond to phone calls. I don't know if they're afraid we're going to be after them with bills, although we usually don't bill very well anyhow, so, or there is some reason. But they respond better by receiving letters. They feel it's safer and non-certified letters. So that was our experience in our case coordination. Baseline levels for many variables were done, including low density lipoprotein, cholesterol, HDL, body mass index, blood pressure, and hemoglobin A1C. The case management and case coordination with goals and objectives for each patient were determined after the initial intake. So the management part of the population followed a similar protocol by utilizing evidence-based guidelines. So these are all diabetics, so we used ADA guidelines. And then, of course, comorbidities. So if they have hypertension, JNC, if they are hyperlipidemic, NCEP guidelines. The management team included a family physician leader, a clinical psychologist, licensed clinical social worker, a nurse health manager, a nurse practitioner who happened to be a registered dietitian in this case. But, of course, you know, needing a nutritionist is essential. As you all know, the chronic disease model is a multidisciplinary system that involves case management, case coordination, multidisciplinary care, nutritional counseling, lifestyle modification, behavioral intervention, including self-management. So many of those components were incorporated on those, well, we say 250 patients, but there were some dropouts that I will talk about. So initially, the patients continued to follow with their family physician or resident, and they were the team was encouraged to give them follow-up every 3 months, which you all know in clinical practice, that's a dream come true. You know, patients come when they want to come. However, with intensive case coordination and case management that we did aggressively, that helped a little bit bringing the patients back. We did take values when they came for regular visits, but also through case coordination, we brought them back to the clinic in order to check some other values and variables. We also encouraged the team to treat any visit as a diabetes visit as well, as opposed to residents tend to treat a URI and send your patient out without looking at anything else. So there was an extensive education for the providers in the clinic. Educational components include self-care, nutrition, physical activity, food care, and social issues. Patients were referred to the clinical psychologist if they were determined through the screening and assessment that they had a psychological issue, including depression and anxiety or any other psychologic ICD. And then if they had obesity or they were smokers, our licensed social worker is experienced in behavioral change, and she worked with the clinician both pharmacologically and behaviorally to work on those issues. Now, non-compliance and social issues were also parts of the social worker's job description and referral patterns. So I don't know how much that shows from there, but this is the protocol. We try to standardize it as much as possible. So you have either a patient encounter or through running a report, we found the patients in the practice through ICD-9 diagnoses. They were put in a registry database. Eventually, our EMR was the database. Initially, our EMR was upgraded in the interim, so now it's much easier to do something like this in the clinic. Before that, we had to use the parallel access database with the identifiers in order to make this happen. So we did an initial assessment by the nurse, and in which they filled a questionnaire and were assisted, and that determined their risk as well as their readiness to change. And then a case management protocol was done for each patient, and accordingly, they were seeing a nutritionist, the social worker again, the clinical psychologist, so this is behavioral, this is nutrition, and or following the guidelines, whether by the nurse practitioner or their physician. Those who dropped out continued usual regular care, basically, by seeing the resident or physician, or those who elected not to be part of this protocol. And then continuous quality improvement and CQI and monitoring of lab and other variables was done. So those patients, at the end of the 3 years, 208 to 210, is when we sat back down and through ICD-9 re-identified the patients from the electronic database and the EMR. We did a retrospective electronic review for the 3 years. IRB approval was obtained from the Meharry IRB. From the 250 patients, we had around 40 dropouts. The inclusion criteria for this analysis were if they had a minimum of two visits at least 1 year apart, plus or minus 1 month. Some patients had more than two visits. So this is, we didn't look into that yet, but we're looking into the number of visits and or improvement, i.e. compliance versus how much the hemoglobin A1C improved. If a patient had only one value, whether it's a baseline or any other value within that year, or values less than a year, they were not included in the analysis. So that excluded 40 patients. SPSS software package version 19 for Windows was used for analysis and pair T testing to compare the values between 0 and 12 months. So, population of 210, predominantly female, 60%. For those of you in primary care, know that women are better than men in seeing the physician. And then predominantly minority. So 66% African-American, 11% Latinos, and 20% Caucasians in our practices, in the two practices. However, with the 11% Latinos, we only had the bilingual Hispanics. We have a population of only Spanish-speaking. It was hard to involve them at this stage because the clinical psychologist was not bilingual that we have. Although they may have benefited from all other aspects of the program, of course, as part of clinical care, so they were not completely excluded. The pay pattern of those patients, as you can see, Medicaid, what is that here? Medicaid plus self-pay, 60% plus 25, 85%, and 15% are Medicare or private insurance, which really represents those two clinics' population. Most of them are urban by self-identifications and zip code, 74%. Now, of course, you know with diabetes, there's a lot of comorbidities, and our patients are similar to other patients of type 2, with 88% have hypertension, 85% have hyperlipidemia, and 94% were obese. After all, we are in Tennessee, and we are like now the sixth most obese state. We're getting better. We were number two, so that's an improvement, according to our statistics. So, the results. Body mass index. Now, all the results were statistically significant with a P of less than 0.001. This is paired t-testing, 37.1 to 34.1 over a year. Diastolic blood pressure from 91 to 82.3. Same thing, I'm not going to repeat those in the interest of time. Systolic blood pressure, statistically significant, from 153 0.1 millimeter of mercury to 135.6. And then hemoglobin A1c from 9.8% to 8%. Now, you know, this is the mean baseline. We have patients up 13, hemoglobin A1c, and 14. And we have patients who are 40 years old chronologically who look 70 physically, basically, because of all those comorbidities. So we are dealing with a sick population. Fortunately, many of them have Medicaid, but still many are uninsured. We don't have the two-year results yet. The LDL 129 to 100.2, and the HDL from 34 to 43 with the same statistical significance. Triglycerides, of course, when you treat diabetes, triglycerides go down usually to 41 to 165. Though remember, you know, these patients were still receiving usual medical care for pharmacologic treatment or what have you by their primary care resident or physician. So 80% of the patients, in summary, had a minimum of two visits, about 81%. We had 40 dropouts, which we did not include in the statistics. There were significant improvements between the means of baseline of hemoglobin A1c, LDL, HDL, triglycerides, blood pressure, and body mass index at 12 months post-intervention compared to the baseline, however, for those who participated. So the results would show that implementing some form of chronic disease management in addition to regular clinical care in a primary care setting improves clinical indicators in patients with type 2 diabetes and also establishes that the chronic care model modified to your own practice does really work as far as improving indicators. Now, this is a study with a lot of limitations. It's only in a two family medicine residency clinics. So generalizability is an issue, of course. However, there are so many family medicine residency clinics in this country. There are 450 residencies, and so there are at least 450 clinics like ours as far as the training component, but they're not all indigent practices. Many of them are suburban. It's a pre- and post-comparison. It's not a randomized trial. But for those of us on the ground have seen randomized trials as well, how limited they are and how restrictive, and they eventually don't apply to a population like ours or population in practice. Dropouts not examined yet, but will be. We're going to look at them if we can find their values and see where they are, and maybe they're coming every 2 years instead of, you know, twice a year minimum. And we'll do a regression analysis and a two-year result, which is still pending. So we're going to run all those and see what we can benefit. In preparation for future direction, which really to expand the program, maybe do a randomized trial, apply it to other chronic disease, mainly starting with diabetes, but then hyperlipidemia, etc., although these are comorbid conditions, and then things like COPD as well, maybe congestive heart failure. So we also need to study the generalizability, cost-effectiveness of the model, and the delivery of care for uninsured minorities. And that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Dr. Zell?
Oh, you're going to do questions now?
Yeah, just
one. Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah, no, I don't know.
Is it possible for you to track the people who did not enroll at all, not including the dropouts, but the people who just either refused?
Yeah, and that's a good point, because we can, if they stayed in the practice, or we can track them in a way, say, they left the practice at a certain time. So we're going to go back, get all the ICD-9s of all diabetics, and then go back to the charts, and now with EMR, maybe easier. See how many visits, where are they now, and how long did they stay, and what happened, and do that comparison. It still won't be a randomized trial, but it still gives you some more ideas, basically. Yeah, it will help. Yes, ma'am.
Can you really quickly go over the things that were most important in the patient education and the residency education?
Yeah, well, I mean, let me tell you, with the residency education, part of our medical home, we had to do continuous conferences in their conference schedule as a general rule about guidelines and about follow-up and about avoiding the episodic care process, basically. In addition, we did QA, like, you know, part, let's say, if we're going to do ADA guidelines review, at the same time, we did a chart audit of their charts and showed them, you know, the non-compliance to make it more practical and fun. And as far as the practitioners and clinical faculty meetings, we went over the process too. However, to be honest with you, what my feeling is, and you know, I may not be able to prove it, all this, the case coordination part, I mean, the nurses part is very valuable in this medical home chronic disease model. And if you can't, especially with non-compliant patients, now you're in a suburban private insured who would come and follow up, maybe it's different. But in our population, bringing those people back was great. I mean, our nurse practitioner told me a story about writing somebody a letter and saying, you need to come follow for your chronic disease. And the patient called her panicking, what is my chronic disease? She said, your diabetes. He said, oh, my diabetes. Okay, then I will come. He didn't realize. Then I told her, change the terminology. You use something they understand. Chronic disease is a big thing. And he didn't realize, though, that he was worried. Chronic disease, diabetes is a chronic disease, basically. So the case coordination is very important, too. So you had a question?
Were your interventions equal in regards to pharmacotherapy and behavioral modification across all your patients?
Yeah, it's probably hard to track that exactly, but that's why we had the protocol reviewed with everybody, basically. But the team was the one who's doing that. You have to remember, whoever was seeing the residents, besides the education we talked about, they didn't do more than that. So we had the team, which is separate, who was really co-monitoring this group. So for instance, if we did a cross-sectional, looking for cross-sectional study or QA, on a certain day looking for the hemoglobin A1Cs done after a year, and they were not done in 20% of the patients. These are the ones we called and brought back, and we didn't wait for the primary care physician to do it. Now, she tried, our nurse practitioner and our nurse tried to tell the primary care physician, you have to do HbA1c, sometimes they won't, residents. And I told them then, let's utilize, there are some articles in the literature where, per protocol, those nurses on their own will order the hemoglobin A1c and track it. So that's what made it more standardized, is that the smaller team is what was standard. The actual practice may not be as standard because it's very hard to train physicians and keep them behaviorally. So
I went beyond my time.
Yeah. Oh no, you weren't beyond. You were just on.
You told me to answer questions.
Yeah, no, that was perfect. I was just, yeah, thank you. That was more for me, not for you. To get up. Just before we move on, thank you again, Dr. Zarb. I wanted to give a few comments on your background since I didn't have your bio up at the time, and thank you for submitting it. Dr. Zarb is the Frank S. Royal Senior Professor and Chair of the Department of Family and Community Medicine at Meharry Medical College, Director of the Family Medicine Programs at Vanderbilt University, and Chief of the Family and Community Medicine at the Metro Nashville General Hospital. He's the PI and director of several federally funded programs, as we can see in this one example on chronic disease management and health disparities research topics. So thank you again. I'll give a clap.